This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Dr. Haider Varaish grew up in Pakistan, where there is a high rate of people with heart disease. His own father suffered a heart attack while Haider was in training in cardiology. His personal experience, seeing loved ones suffer from heart disease, fueled his passion for his research. It also drove him to find out why heart disease research is not as well-funded as other illnesses like cancer. His new book, State of the Heart, combines a deep dive into the ancient history with his own personal experiences and the contemporary science of cardiac disease. Haider Varaish is a fellow at the Advanced Heart Failure and Transplantation at Duke University Medical Center, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me back, Frank.
Tell us about the genesis of this book and kind of what it's all about and why you wrote it.
So, Frank, as you've mentioned, I'm finishing up my training in cardiology, and over the course of training, we learn a lot of things in the moment. We learn about how to treat heart attacks, how to treat abnormal heart rhythms. But my interest went kind of beyond that, and I wanted to know how we got here in the first place. What did it take? What are the missteps we've taken along the road? And what can that teach us about where we might be headed in the future? I mean, the heart is probably the most well-studied organ in human history. It's been an object of obsession and fascination by us since really the dawn of time. In fact, the first story of any type written ever, the Epic of Gilgamesh, really centered around the human heart and trying to figure out what it means for us, not just as an organ that beats, since we are a fetus until we die, but really as what it means for us as human beings as a metaphor.
Yeah, as you say, it has been this central metaphor in all of human history from the dawn of storytelling anyway, as well as the science, kind of how does it work and what do we need to do to take care of it? And I think that has been what you studied and talked about in this book, but you also mentioned sort of where we are and how we got here. It really isn't a single path. I mean, if you look at the way the Egyptians understood the heart or in other civilizations, it's not a straight line to modern medicine today at all.
Totally not. And, you know, one of the things that I was really fascinated by when I took this deep dive into history was that sometimes the very people that we look to for guidance and for to help us find the truth, i.e., you know, the experts, a lot of times they're the ones who have been the biggest roadblocks to our understanding of how the heart works. Take, for example, one of the most influential cardiologists or heart physicians of any sort of all time, Galen, who was an ancient Greek. And one of the things that Galen did was that he came up with this theory of the four humors that has really pervaded our imagination for thousands of years. Now, one of the things that Galen did was that his whole theory was based on this premise that there are invisible holes in the heart that help blood go from one chamber to another. And this theory that he then postulated lasted for more than almost 1,500 years. The interesting thing was that Galen had never opened a human heart. This was just based on his belief, and everyone that followed him just took it on because it was almost blasphemy to question it so much. Until thousands of years later, when someone actually did an autopsy, even when people saw it with their own eyes, even people like Leonardo da Vinci, when he opened the heart and he did not see the pores, he did not challenge that idea. He just went with it. And so to me, this was a really, really interesting story because it goes to the heart of what science is. And science really, and as we sort of, as things change during the Renaissance, it's really about observation and experimentation. And I think when we start straying from that and go back into thinking about science more as a belief, as something that was passed along to us and that we'll just nod and move forward, I think we go back on what really has been the reason why science is able to bring us to this point. And that story to me isn't just one, but it's something that's going on right now. I think about in 50 years, what are the things that we're doing today that we learned were actually not true? And we did them just because it was based on our belief and trust rather than something that we had observed ourselves.
Well, but that's not necessarily the same thing because you've, I think, put your finger on the importance of the framework, both the intellectual, right, and the so-called social and psycho-social framework. if this is what you believe and you think there are things called humors, now everything's got to fit the humor model. And when it does, you make it fit. And anything that doesn't fit, even a keen observer like Da Vinci, throws it out. Can't be, because it doesn't fit that framework. And modern science does have a framework, right, within which you must work. And so even as you say, the founder of Johns Hopkins works against medical science to some extent because there's a way in which he believes, and maybe we can tell that story here, kind of, you know, how high blood pressure or how blood pressure works. Right?
So this is a great story, and it goes back. So one of the things that I learned in medical school and then during the rest of my training is that most cases of hypertension are referred to as essential hypertension. And no one really told me ever why we call it essential hypertension. And then when I was researching the book, I learned that the reason it's called essential hypertension was because it was thought that it was essential for us to have high blood pressure. In fact, the first U.S. president to ever have his blood pressure measured, Taft, his blood pressure reading was so high that if it were done today, he would be actually admitted to the hospital. But at that point, it was thought to be a good thing. He actually wrote, "Phew, I got a good report from the doctor." And this really was followed by really all the leading medical experts of that time and afterwards, including Sir William Osler, who was, you know, great founder of Johns Hopkins, who believed that the worst thing that you could do for high blood pressure is to actually treat it. Now we know today that high blood pressure, and at one point was killing one in every other person in the United States, we've learned that over decades and decades of research, but it took a lot to overturn some of those expert opinions that actually held us back from really thinking about what we can do to help help the heart and also help the humans who live with it. So, but as you mentioned before, I think that that the scientific framework that exists today is pretty robust. And if anything, I have more confidence in it today than we have before. Certainly with mediums such as Twitter and other social media, there's a lot more openness to criticism of research by other researchers. And that's, I think, increasing the transparency of what we're doing. But this is balanced by this increasing sense of, you know, anti-science and anti-factualness that is growing in our society. Some of the main targets of that happen to be things like vaccines, but in cardiology, one of the big targets are cholesterol medications called statins. And to me, I think that this is the really what we're going to have to sort of deal with in the future, is how to not just educate people about specific aspects of what we know about human biology, but teach people about science, teach them about what research is, what different types of studies are, what type of conclusions you can make from different types of studies. And I hope to achieve some of that through this book.
But one of the things that we as lay people do observe over time is the way science changes. We're happy for that. We're happy that we acknowledge that what we thought was true before now appears not to be. It is a little confusing, and it does mean that one shouldn't necessarily put total faith in the latest theory, because there is a chance it will be overturned. In fact, it's likely.
I think a healthy amount of skepticism is probably extremely important, not just for the patient or the person who just wants the best for themselves or their loved one, but also for the physician and for the researcher. At the same time, I think there are some things that we do need to draw the line for. I think vaccines are an easy target. I think we have a lot of data that suggests that vaccines are safe and they have saved, you know, millions of lives. But I couldn't agree with you more. I think a healthy amount of skepticism is important, but also this idea that, you know, science is not made up of absolutes. It's science is incremental at its very core. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I think even though we should be skeptical of it, I think we need to be better educated about what the sources of that data are, what the limitations of that data are, so that we are, you know, almost humbled by it. And I think that's necessary if you're going to continue to have this dialogue with people who may have suspicions or about our intentions.
Remind us of your own personal history with cardiology. I made some reference to it in our introduction, and how you became interested in this organ.
So, Frank, growing up in Pakistan, one of the things that was really pervasive around me was that heart disease could really happen to anyone. Anyone, you know, young or old, could have a heart attack at any point. We now know that South Asians, people from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, are some of the highest risk people to have heart disease. So it was something that I grew up with. My dad had a heart attack when I was in training in cardiology. But not just him, you know, dads of my friends, my own grandmother, she had a cardiac arrest. And so we were surrounded by people having these catastrophic heart attacks. And that was one reason why I was inspired to go down this path. The other thing that's, I think, one of the things that I've really been fascinated by over the more recent years is how, even though heart disease kills more people than any other disease in the world, it's almost become the forgotten disease. It's almost like, even though we're having so many innovations and advances in cardiology and how to help people's hearts live as well as long as possible, it just didn't capture, or it doesn't capture the imagination of people. There's so many stories that I saw of patients or people with heart disease, and of the physicians who, you know, almost heroically in many, many times were treating them, that I just didn't see. And so it was, to me, there's this paradox of, you know, how can a disease that's so common, that touches so many, have so little space when it comes to the imagination of the public? And that's one of the reasons why I was especially drawn to cardiology, because I felt that not just the science, not just the clinical care, but there were stories of patients with heart disease and those who treat it that were being untold. And that's one of the other things that I really wanted to focus on here.
Well, I want to hear some of those, but I want to also look at the difference here between, you know, because we know more money goes into cancer research than heart research, but and yet more people die of heart disease than of cancer. Now, are they dying of heart disease for lack of research? We don't know what to do with them, because that is what the research in cancer is all about. We need to fix this thing. We don't know how to get rid of it in some cases. Or we just can't get them. It's access. We know how to fix that. If we could get to that population that was suffering from this, we could fix them easily.
So right now, you know, Frank, I think that's a great point. And I would say that heart disease in ways is almost becoming, it's not a medical impairment anymore. It's almost an economic ailment. Mm. You know, we have, heart disease is not like other diseases like dementia or ALS, in which we are waiting for the next big thing. The next big thing is already here. And you can get it for pennies from Walmart or Costco or wherever you get your medications for. The challenge is, how can we get patients access to those medications? How can we make sure that people with heart disease or who are at high risk for heart disease are diagnosed and then are treated accordingly to reduce their risk of having heart attacks? You know, health insurance is a big issue and is one big reason for access. But even amongst people who have health insurance, we're seeing, and there's a lot of data to suggest that many patients don't get the optimal therapy, even things simple and cheap in inexpensive things. And I think for now, that is the main challenge that is ahead of us. Having said that, I think one of the reasons why there's this difference between cancer, which is, you know, a terrible disease, and heart disease, is that they have these different stories. There's a different narrative. Cancer, is almost there's an outsider attacking
your body.
It's an
invader, right? Yeah.
And so I think it, fuels the inner xenophobe in all of us. So, you know, there's an outsider. You know, we can't have that happen to us. And with heart disease, you know, it's almost like, oh, this is an age-related process. As you get older, everyone gets heart disease. Or, you know, this is a car, it's breaking down, and you just need to take it to the workshop for a tune-up. And I think those stories really, that type of narrative is damaging, because I think that it minimizes the toll that heart disease can take on people's lives. And I think that has to change if we are to reduce the burden that heart disease is placing on people, not just here, but really around the world.
And earlier when you talked about access, you're pointing to social determinants, not only for access to therapies for people to treat it, but the fact that you might be more susceptible because of your social and economic situation. And that's something, and particularly when it comes to women. In fact, you've got a story to tell when it comes to women not being taken seriously enough when it comes to heart disease or other diseases as well.
I mean, in this book, I've changed a lot of details and I'm taken off identifiers. But I remember I was once walking in the hospital. It was night, and I was one of the, you know, probably one of the only two cardiologists in the entire hospital. And I heard a patient who was really seemed to be having a lot of difficulty breathing. It wasn't my patient. I was just there, and I heard, you know, this patient. She was by herself, so I went and just talked to the nurse. Said, "Hey, by the way, you know, I just noticed, you know, is everything okay?" And I was told that, she's anxious. Can you give me some Ativan, which is a relaxant? And I went and saw her, and her lips were blue, and she was not anxious. She could get no oxygen. And actually, within minutes, we realized that she was having a respiratory collapse, and we had to send her to the intensive care unit. And after this was all done, and the dust had settled, I sat down, and I really thought about this. Would we say the same if that patient were a man? Would we say the same thing that if a man were having difficult breathing or his lips were blue, he's just having a panic attack? And I feel like another story that I shared in the book was of Catherine Leon. She was she's now doing great work as an patient advocate, but she had a heart attack right after she had her second son. And she had to go to the emergency room multiple times before anyone would take her seriously. And the irony is that when she was eventually diagnosed with having a heart attack, it was actually a female physician who saw her. And so I think that, you know, we have come too far to have these types of disparities still happen. Not only do we need to educate people that, you know, heart disease is not a man's disease, it is a woman's disease. And in fact, that was some of the what I learned the most writing the chapter on heart disease in women, and is probably my favorite chapter and part of the book. But not only is it important to know that, you know, women have heart disease as much as men do, but we also need to teach that to our physicians, we need to teach that to our nurses, to EMS, really across the medical workforce. But we also have to realize that heart disease in women is different from men. We can't just take the same treatments or just think that, we will use the same treatments that we use for men, or we'll use the same type of, frameworks that were, initially discovered in men and apply them to women. But we really need to think about how is heart disease different in women, and how can we tailor therapy to their specific needs?
And do we open the research to, and again, broaden this framework for scientific study and medical evaluation to include social determinants, so that on the one hand, we can improve our therapies through the kind of research we're doing today in the labs, but that's too late for people who grew up poor and oppressed by police departments and whatever else they're experiencing that's causing this? Is it the responsibility of medical research to say, let's stop this before it becomes a symptom?
I couldn't agree more. And if you look at, you know, how the U.S., is well-known fact, spends more on healthcare than any other country in the world, but we don't spend as much on social welfare as other countries do. And I think that now that medicine has taken on this huge chunk of our budget, I think it is our responsibility not just to come up with the newest, shiniest instruments and procedures, but also start looking at the populations that we serve. Just right in our neighborhoods, some of the best and most prestigious hospitals in the world are surrounded by neighborhoods with the worst health. We need to start realigning ourselves and focus on population health. And part of that has to do with changing how healthcare is paid for. I mean, right now, healthcare is paid on a fee-for-service basis. So the more you do, the more you get paid. And we need to move away from that if we're going to serve populations in an equitable way. We need to make sure that we move towards population-based payments, so you get paid for the outcomes you achieve in an entire population, rather than you just do more and you'll get paid more. And I think that type of, and those are some of the interesting things that that medicine is not just medicine alone. It is sociology, it is economics, it is all these things combined.
And politics.
Of course.
Dr. Heider Verreich is a cardiologist and a fellow at the Advanced Heart Failure and Transplantation at Duke University Medical Center. His book is State of the Heart, Exploring the History, Science, and Future of Cardiac Disease. And you can catch Heider at the Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh at the end of July for a book launch. We've got it at our website, stateofthings.org. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks again, Frank.
Coming up, okra. You love it, you hate it, but one way or another, it's going to be on your plate because you're in the South. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. Stay tuned.